This is going to sound weird, but I'm going to count three, two, one, and then I want you to clap so I can find out how to sync the tracks.
Okay. Yeah, good shout.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Three, two, one. Just the one clap, mate.
Oh, right. I thought I meant like an audience.
No. Three, two, one. I whacked my mic again. Okay. Hello, you are listening to Dev Brood, a podcast exploring the ups and downs of an independent iOS developer and the founder of a microbrewery. Your hosts are me, Dominic Williams, creator of the app Moderation, and Glenn White, founder of Brew Monster, a microbrewery based in South Wales. We'll be exploring topics such as marketing, business strategy, and raising capital, as well as the simpler things in life, like staying motivated when everything else seems to be going wrong. Welcome back to Dev Brood. Today we're going to talk about raising capital and investment. We're going to talk about the different types of investment you can raise, such as borrowing money or getting money from investors. And we're also going to talk about when is the right time to raise money, how much should you raise, and a lot more. To start with, Glenn, why don't you tell us about the history of Brew Monster and raising capital?
Okay, yeah, so Brew Monster, the industry we're in, it's obviously quite a capital intensive industry. You need a lot of equipment, you need premises, you need to buy all your stocks, there's a lot of working capital. So it's quite a capital intensive industry to enter, so you do need a funding, you know, right up front before you even start, before you've even got any beer to share with the world, you generally would need funding. There are some exceptions to that. You could start off with a home brewing, obviously a lot cheaper, but the way we did it, we went straight in with a reasonable size kit. It was certainly a commercial kit, bigger than anything you'd have as a home brewer, but not massive compared to a lot of what the industry would have. We did five rounds of investment to date. We started off targeting about 80,000. We thought we would need to get started. We started off by raising debt. We used a scheme called the Startup Loans Company. It's a government-backed initiative, provides personal loans to directors of business to help you get started. Fairly low criteria in terms of, you know, what they'll accept, because it's a government-backed scheme, and because it's a personal debt, you know, you're on the hook to sort of pay it back, so it's a bit lower risk for them. So it's a fairly easy way to start off. So we raised some debt funding initially, that got the ball rolling, but before we launched, we also did an equity raise right from the start. It was somewhere between sort of crowdfunding and sort of just taking on, you know, a private investor, like an angel investor or something like that. So we had a group of friends who all put in various amounts from 1,000 up to £6,000. In total, we raised 44,000 from that scheme. We used a scheme called Seed Enterprise Investment Scheme, which is a great scheme. It allows investors who invest into SEIS, which is the abbreviation for it. It allows investors who invest into SEIS companies to recover half of their investment via their tax. So, you know, obviously there's various criteria from the company side, from the investor side, but it's a great scheme. So it means it effectively massively reduces the risk for an investor, really helps small businesses like we were. Obviously, we weren't even a business at that point. Really helps you to raise funding when it's your high-risk company, and to get the ball rolling, really.
Okay, I got a couple of questions on some of that. You mentioned that at that point you weren't even a business. How did you know how much money you needed to raise?
We did a business plan. So we, you know, we spoke to, you know, manufacturers of equipment. We looked at premises. We had a brewer who was going to be part of the initial team, so he had a decent understanding of what things would be involved in, you know, to actually be able to make a brew. So what ingredients would be needed, you know, how much of the ingredients, what different tools and bits and bobs would be needed. Obviously being an accountant, I did a financial model, thought about working capital. So, you know, if it takes us X amount of time to sell and we go in, say, 30-day terms, you know, do we get terms as a small business starting up? Maybe not. So, you know, we assume that everything we're paying for is cash. Did basically put together a financial model, really.
Did you plan for a certain period of time that you could run without making any money? Was it like 6 months or...?
we did sort of work out that, you know, if we did various scenarios, we did sort of scenarios where if we really struggle to sell initially, how long can we be paying the bills if we're only brewing, say, once a week or once every couple of weeks? How long have we got to really get sales up to a manageable point? So yeah, we did do that from the start, just to understand, you know, how long have we got to survive if worst happens and we can't sell anything.
Okay, I think you mentioned a few UK specific sort of schemes, the Seed Enterprise Investment Scheme being one, and then the, what's the name of the loans one, sorry?
Startup Loans Company.
Startup Loans. I guess for any listeners, we can put the links in the show notes and they can look at this, but for people, you know, in America or elsewhere, there's probably equivalent schemes or, you know, grants or other incentives, I guess, for new businesses as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing that's become quite a worldwide phenomenon, and it's something that we've done, so like I mentioned, we've done, I think, five fundraisers altogether. Our most recent one was crowdfunding. So we used Crowdcube, they're called crowdcube.com. It's effectively like we did on our first one, where we had a group of friends all putting from £1,000 up to £6,000 each. But this one was, you know, this type of crowdfunding is people can put in from £10 up to almost unlimited how much they want to put in. Crowdcube effectively allows people from all over the world to invest anything from £10 up to, you know, thousands of pounds. In exchange, they get equity in the business. They can get the tax benefits in the same way as we've done with getting people privately. But also you often offer rewards. So maybe, well, in our case, we offered T-shirts for people invested at a £100 level, free cases of beer for people invested a £1,000 level. And you rewards can go all the way up into the tens of thousands. Some breweries out there have raised money and offered. They, you know, come in for a day, do a custom brew on the equipment, meet all the staff, etc. So, you know, it's a, you know, that's, and that's a scheme that is a lot more worldwide.
Okay, I want to try and break down your five stages, really. So, the first stage, you didn't have a business, you raised 80k. At what point did you raise money again?
The first two fundings were pretty much together. The debt was initial, the first one. The debt was the first one, just because that was a little bit easier, lower bar to get over, effectively, to get it. Having raised a little bit of debt funding, that got the ball rolling. And then we went and spoke to the investors to say, why don't you invest in this business? They could see we've already raised some money. We've put, you know, we've got a bit of skin in the game. We've put our necks on the line and taken these personal loans to put into the business. So that made that a little bit easier then to raise money. So yeah, at the point of when we were, you know, when the costs really started to come, when we were really buying the equipment, committing the premises, we had, well, we actually went over our target and we had close to 90,000 from those two funding rounds.
Okay, so the third and fourth were, again, just raising from the same initial investors?
So the third one was another equity raise. We doubled the price of the shares, in effect. We offered it to the initial investors who would invest the first time. Some came in again, some decided not to. But then we went out to other people that we knew. And at this point, we had doubled the value of the company on the basis that people that came in the first time, it was just, they were just investing in an idea and a business plan. This time, even though it was only sort of 8-9 months later, the business was up and running. We were selling beer. We were having good feedback on the beer. People could try the beer. They could come and see the premises if they wanted to and see the brewery, how it works. At that point, we actually had a genuine business that people could see and understand and, you know, had confidence that we weren't going to fail before we even got started. So that's how we raised money. We raised, we capped that funding at £40,000, which equated to diluting everybody by 10% of the company. So that's the one trade-off when you do these equity raises is, every share you're giving out, you're reducing everyone else's share in the company. So it is something you've got to balance up with. Yeah, you can go out, you can raise equity funding. You don't have to pay that funding back, which sounds great. You're getting effectively free money. The shareholders can have these tax advantages. But every time you do it, the more shares you're giving out, the more you're diluting your existing investors.
I guess, you know, for people starting a business and listeners who may be listening to this show, part of that is diluting your own share as well, you know, as a founder or, you know, an owner of a company. each time you're raising funding, you're giving away a part of that company effectively.
Absolutely, yeah. So yeah, it and obviously, you know, one of our sort of say secrets, if you will, although it's not really a secret, is we got a large team of people all bring their specialist skills in design and brewing and finance, and we've always given out a lot of shares to all these people. So, you know, I own approximately a third of the company, but every time we do an equity raise, my share decreases, and the workload only ever increases. So it's almost that catch 22 where you can raise more money, creates more work because, you know, you've got more aspects to your business to manage, more people to manage, but actually your percentage ownership of that business continues to shrink. So it is something to think about. It's definitely not something to go into lightly. The discussion of debt versus equity isn't a no-brainer that equity or debt is always better. It's very much you've got to look at each decision in isolation and really think about what's best for you at that point in time. So if we fast forward to when we did our fourth fundraising, so just as a reminder, we did debt and equity roughly the same time pre-launch. Sort of 8 or 9 months later, we did an equity raise of 40,000. Another 5 or 6 months on from that, we did another debt raise where we raised 50,000, and that was sort of as a £50,000 loan. Now, the thinking at this point in time was the reason we went for debt over another equity raise, because we could have done another equity raise, there were people who would have been happy to invest again. But when we looked at our business, where we'd had the 40,000 and the third raise, we'd made progress in that time, but we knew there was more progress to be made. So had we gone and done another equity raise at that point, we wouldn't have been able to justify a high business value. So for us to raise 50,000, we would have been diluted by another 10%. So what we decided to do was do a debt raise at that point. Because at this point in time, we were opening a tap room in the brewery, we were opening a micro pub, we were expanding our equipment, so we had a lot of things going on. So we decided to do the debt raise, don't dilute at that point, and then another sort of 6 months later, when the micro pub's up and running, making you know, profitable, the tap room is open, also profitable, the new equipment is in place, capacity's increased. At that point, we had a much stronger business with a really good story that we could justify going from the valuation which we put on the company of 440,000 or 400,000 pre-money value at the third raise. Now we're a year on, and then we're justifying a valuation of 1.1 million. So does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. So, you know, I guess, again, you know, translating this for people listening, it's not clear cut, you know, simply just raising equity all the time. You know, you are going to lose your sort of proportion in the company, and sometimes it may actually not make sense. And the example you're saying is, you know, you knew you could generate more value from the business raising debt and then raising equity later on at the higher valuation.
Absolutely, yeah.
I guess as well, from a like financial kind of accounting world, stuff like gearing ratios and things like that play into this a bit.
Yes, well, actually, at the point that we did the third raise, the equity raise, we were speaking to various businesses, various sort of business advisory services at the time. One of the conversations I remember having was about, you know, raising more funding, you know, furthering our growth. And what they said, what they had suggested was, if you raise equity first, it puts your, you know, improves your balance sheet in terms of net assets, your cash balance. If at that point you go and raise debt, then you're in a stronger position. You might be able to negotiate better interest rates. You know, maybe reduced covenants. If you go to a bank, then they might want certain covenants. You might be able to negotiate a better deal for yourself effectively because you've got the stronger balance sheet there to back it up. Doing it the other way around and doing the debt first, if you're in a weaker position, then it's higher risk for the lender. They might put in additional covenants, higher interest rates to manage their risk. So there is a lot to consider each time you do a fundraise.
So you mentioned, I think, the fifth and most recent round of investment was done a bit differently, using a sort of crowdfunding platform. Maybe you can talk a bit about that process, how easy or difficult it was. You know, would you recommend it? When is the right time to do that?
Yeah, so I think prior to starting that fundraise, I'd been a member of Crowdcube for probably about a year. I'd go on it fairly regularly. partly to check out the competition, because a lot of breweries go on there, so you know, I go on there, invest small amounts into them, have a, you know, get access to their books, you know, their business model, understand a little bit more about them, and equally look at other business on there as well. One of the, so obviously, and one of the things that come out to the back of that is knowing that when you are going to go on, say CrowdTube as the example, you know, to do this public crowdfunding, you are going to have to put a certain amount of information out there, which is going to be accessible to all your competitors. So it, you know, you are trading off, you know, one of the things it does offer is it does get your name and your brand out there, because I think CrowdCube claimed to have hundreds of thousands of people signed up to the platform, whether they're all active users, I'm not really sure, but all those people will have access to your business. They, you know,
I think it's an interesting way to get an understanding of how the process works. You mentioned you've invested in quite a few, you know, breweries, small amounts. And I think you said it starts at £10. So, you know, for people out there wondering how does the process work, they can, for as little as £10, invest in a company, see what happens, see what information gets shared, how the process works, how the shares get issued, and sort of build up a bit of confidence before they want to, you know, go on there and try and raise their own money.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems a no-brainer to me to think, you know, if some of your competitors are using these platforms, it's a no-brainer to certainly join. You know, you request access to the documents, they grant you access, then you can have a look and make a decision if you want to invest. So I would say it's a no-brainer to at least join these platforms, get comfortable with it, understand how it works, look at what your competitors are doing, you know, have a bit of an insight into their business, what their plans are for the business. You know, it's invaluable information anyway, even if you decide not to go ahead and do your own fundraising on there.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, which I know we've spoken about previously, but I think the listeners will really get some value from, is your strategy of small raises, but maybe more frequent, as opposed to, you know, raising £500,000, and you know, which I think some of the breweries you mentioned, some competitors have done that strategy, whereas you're going for a smaller, more regular sort of fundraise, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I noticed when I first started looking at CrowdCube was the breweries were on there raising eye-watering amounts of money. As far, you know, from my perspective, and look from our business perspective, from the perspective of our business, eye-watering amounts of money, you know, hundreds of thousands minimum, 500, 700, a million, million and a half, some of them. It's sort of crazy amounts of money. And then you sort of have a look at some of their financials, and you sort of see, you know, and sometimes I'm scratching my head thinking, how can these companies, and not necessarily that much bigger than us, sometimes they're burning hundreds of thousands in overheads. And you sort of look at our own business and think, you know, we quibble over, you know, £20 subscription to a, you know, a CRM system, or barter over, you know, a couple of pound here and there on our sales. So one of the things that we always, one of the sort of the principles that we've always worked on is we do these small raises, do them more regularly, but those small raises really keep us disciplined in, you know, because we know what to start the business. You know, penny pinching everywhere we can, you know, to, you know, preserve the cash flow. It goes back to like the question earlier, how long can we last if we can't sell? So, you know, from the start, you're watching every penny that goes out the door. And we've tried to maintain that same principle and that same strategy by only doing relatively small raises. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, £40,000-£50,000 is a lot of money, but doing £40,000-£50,000, go and demonstrate that you can use that effectively, deliver a return on it. I think then you go back and raise money again. I think, you know, people, I think, really appreciate that strategy, because they know that, you know, if they, you know, when they're investing, they're not investing for you to go and have a corporate away day and spend £10,000 or something. They know every penny you're watching. You know, you run low on cash, get a little bit twitchy sometimes when your cash is running down, and you think, oh, are we going to have to finish this particular project? But, you know, so far it's worked for us to do it in that way.
I think you mentioned cash flow a few times, and I think it's a really interesting point. So, you know, from my perspective, thinking about when do you raise money? And, you know, one is the cash flow element of most businesses being the sort of Achilles heel. You know, you run out of cash, it doesn't matter if you're profitable, that's it, you go bust. And then you've got the kind of growth reason, I guess, where, you know, you've maybe got a healthy cash flow, but not the funds to really grow into the market you want or at the pace you want. How do you, with Brew Monster, you know, keep control of cash flow, keep an eye on it? You know, when you mentioned sometimes you get twitchy, when what triggers that? How is there any sort of advice you can give people listening to you know, not make the mistake that so many small businesses seem to make, which is just running out of cash.
Yeah, I think you've got to be constantly looking at your cash, see what you're owed, understand what's outstanding and what's overdue, and really chase down, because customers are quick to take your product, but they're not always quick to pay you. And it's tough to walk the line between not wanting to upset a relationship with a good customer, but ultimately, I always say they're not a good customer if they're not paying you. So you want to keep the good relationships. You know, you got to appreciate that, you know, they might be struggling themselves, but you've just got to balance that with they've still got to pay you. They're not a good customer if they're not paying you. So that would be one thing. But yeah, you just got to stay close to it. You've got to know what you owe. You've got to know everything you're spending. You've got to have a particular eye on if you're buying product. You know, say in our example, we're buying raw materials. You know, hops, malt, yeast. You know, some quite expensive products. If you're buying them on credit, you've definitely got to have an eye on how much you're spending on those things, because the bill is going to land on your doorstep soon. And some of these bigger companies that you're buying it from, they are going to have maybe more aggressive chase cycles. So you just want to make sure that you don't always want to look at just what you've got in the bank. You want to be looking at what you're spending and what you might owe, and then also look at what's owed to you and make sure you're going to get that money and make sure you stay on top of it. In terms of timing, is you cut like you so you your cash flow might run down as you're sort of investing in a project, etc. But you've got to be looking maybe 2-3 months down the line as well in terms of when the cash is going to be needed, because a crowd cube fund, for example, or a debt raise, they not something that happens overnight. It can take weeks or even into months to actually, from when you start the process, to getting the cash into your bank. Crowd cube in particular is a long one in comparison to the debt and the other ones that we've done, because you go through the process of getting effectively listed on there. You then give everybody 30 days to invest, and then you've got a completion process after that. A lot of companies, if they don't hit their target in 30 days, they might extend for another 30 days. So your business might be live for 2 months on the platform. Then you might easily be looking at another month after that for completion. That's 3 months. And even up front to get on there, it can be weeks, because you've got to put your pitch together. You know, it's got to go through a certain amount of audit process to verify some of the information you're saying in there. So just be aware that, if you're running out of cash, you need to look at, so perhaps the type of funding you use will also be determined by how quickly you need the cash. If you need cash tomorrow to pay a bill, probably the bank is probably the only way to do it, or you maybe the directors need to put their hands in their pockets or something along those lines. Whereas if you're thinking, in 3 months we're going to need cash because it's going to be a busy period of time for us, and we're going to need to invest in stock, or we're looking to launch a new product or new business, and we're going to need money in 3, 4, 5 months, maybe crowdfunding is the way to go, but get crack on it now.
That's a good point. Out of curiosity, in terms of like the debt raises, what's the turnaround time on those?
I would probably say from start to finish, can be a month, because they're always going to insist on a business plan. There's certain anti-money laundering checks, like looking at your ID, verifying your address, bank details, etc., etc. In variable as well, things pop out where, so taking the startup loans for example, sorry, the startup loans company example, they wanted us to make sure all three of us were official directors as reflect on company's house, and that the shares were all in place and reflect on company's house. So these were things we hadn't necessarily thought of when we were going through the process. Came out very, very last minute. Had to get all of these processed. Only took a few days, luckily enough, but things can happen just as you're about to put your application in or during the application process. And then take the second loan we took, which was with the Development Bank of Wales. Slightly different with them. Got all the business plan, all the ID checks, all done quite swiftly up front. Then they went through their sort of internal review process. But then at the back of that, they came out with, we want evidence of this, that, and whatever.
It's interesting. I think your two debt raises have been effectively, or sound like, kind of government-backed loan schemes. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So have you thought about banks directly, or is there a reason why you're discarding just a loan from a bank?
No, that's a good question. I think there's probably two parts to that. One is our primary trading bank account is with a company called Tide, which is one of these sort of challenger online banks. And they have a sort of, given that they're not like a high street bank, they don't really have as sort of a sophisticated lending process as a high street bank that you haven't got an account manager you can ring up and speak to, and you know, so it's slightly different. And then the other side, we do have a high street bank account with TSB, but TSB are shocking, as everybody knows from all the IT issues they've had over the last year. So I'm not sure if they offer finance anymore, but I certainly wouldn't use them for that reason. But it's on my to-do list somewhere quite low down, probably, to have a look at maybe moving to a new bank, consolidating all the different accounts with one high street bank, and then we could maybe look at what funding could be available through them, because there are other options like invoice discounting, where effectively you lend against the value of your sales invoices. So it's a way to bring forward receipt of the cash, really, for the product you're selling. Obviously, you know, you pay interest, etc. on it. There's costs involved, but that's one thing they can offer.
Sounds like a payday loan.
Yeah, yeah, it sort of is, actually, I guess, isn't it? Maybe that's where payday loans came from. So they might offer different options. And obviously, if we were to look at buying property in the future, you know, we'd probably be going through one of those then. You know, because it'd be talking about mortgages and things. You know, you can't get mortgages through these sort of government-backed initiatives.
Was this interest-based sort of benefits, or I guess the first sort of loan was probably, it's probably a lot easier to raise from the government than it is, you know, a bank, especially.
Yeah, so I think the startup loans company, I think the big, say, advantage of those was the checks and they're not looking for like really high credit scores. They understand that you're a new startup business, you might not have experience in doing business plans, etc. So I think, you know, they're a bit more easygoing in terms of what they, you know, who they lend to, perhaps more so than a high street bank.
I think I'm surprised that, you know, the startup loans company didn't require 1 year's worth of sort of trading accounts.
Yeah, I think they rely on the forecast you put together instead.
That was a joke.
It's a joke because, yeah, you can literally put anything together. I remember someone saying that the only people in the world that ever want a business plan or a business model is a bank and a venture capitalist, because no one, you know, in business ever actually uses a business plan. But one of the advantages of both sort of government-backed schemes, which I don't know if I would assume it doesn't carry across to high street banks and other lenders, is they don't charge any early repayment charges, arrangement fees, of very little in the way of these little add-on fees. You know, if you've ever had a mortgage, you'll have, you know, a valuation fee, an arrangement fee, and a completion fee, and any other fee they can come up with a name for. So that's one of the things that sort of seem, they're a bit more transparent, and they don't add on those little fees. So it's a bit more, this is your interest rate, and generally interest rates are pretty competitive as well.
I think my favourite fee for getting my mortgage was the fee for paying by a debit card, because I guess the alternative was turning up with a suitcase full of cash.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bonkers. Well, we've just been buying a house, so me and my brother got a small rental portfolio. We're buying our fourth rental property, buy-to-let property. And at the very last minute, they said, because this is your fourth property, you now classify as a portfolio landlord, and you can still have exactly the same mortgage, the same interest rate, the same repayments, everything, except we're going to check on a £2,000 extra charge because you're now a portfolio landlord, which is just bonkers.
Yeah, that's weird.
I guess they just see that we must be doing something right, and you know, we're making a bit of money, and hence they want a bigger cut of that money from us.
So you mentioned some high numbers, you know, Crowdcube, you know, £1 million. Some people are raising, and it sounds fairly easy. You've done 5 rounds, you know, debt and equity. What should people be raising money for? You know, what should they be spending on?
I would definitely caution people against spending money on vanity projects. So, for example, like we said, it can be, relatively speaking, easy to raise a couple of £100,000 if you've got like a decent brand and you know you're in a good industry, an interesting industry, perhaps like brewing, which has got quite a good following of beer lovers and who are happy to support via crowdfunding, etc. Especially with the pressure that's been set by some other breweries in the past. I would definitely caution people against then wasting that money by spending it on, I don't know, a launch party or a swanky, you know, yes, look how much money we've raised, a big crowdfunding party, etc. Because for two parts. One is that it's not a good practice anyway. It's not something that I think would go down well in the eyes of most of those people who supported you. And I guess then it's not just that you're hurting yourself and those investors, but you could be hurting other people in the future that go and raise money through that same platform. Because, you know, those investors are going to may feel a little bit left down if they see they're putting their hard-earned money into your business, and then they see you having photos of you, having a cool party with a, you know, band, big name band, etc. Or perhaps they see you, you know, your next thing, you on first-class flights all over the world to raise sales, in inverted commas. So I would definitely caution against sort of, you know, just try and remember where you've come from and why you're raising money and, you know, the hard work you've done in those early years to get the business to where it is. Try and stick to those same principles and not get carried away and become a sort of a corporate beast.
I think it's interesting because Brewmonster had a launch party, but you sort of did a few things to make that, you know, not as extravagant or as expensive as, you know, I guess some of these other companies may do. Do you want to speak a bit about that?
Absolutely, yeah. So we obviously we're lucky that we make beer. So, you know, the best thing you can have at a party is free beer. So luckily we can make we make our own beer. So we can offer people free beer and it doesn't cost us that much to do. We tapped into a couple of people that we know, a couple of, you know, contacts, managed to swindle a free hotel, sort of big, you know, nice 4-star hotel in Cardiff. You know, got their big ballroom, weren't being used this night, so they said we could have it for free. Brought our own beer in, so we had a very cheap night, but at the same time was able to give out free beer to everybody. And, you know, we put on a little bit of entertainment. We found a cheap singer to bring on. She was very good, but, you know, ticks the box. So yeah, and we've done other events in the past, as you know, but we've done, you know, so we did a launch party when we had a tap room, but again, free beer. We went to the local fish and chip shop, bought a big massive tray of chips and a massive tray of sausages, cost us next to nothing. In fact, actually, we traded them for a free keg of our beer, so we were able to put on free food and free beer on this event. And again, it cost us very little because it was all just beer, which we obviously make, you know, for, you know, relatively modest price.
I think you touched on an interesting sort of strategy there, you know, in exchanging some beer for the sort of fish and chips from the local chippy. Obviously raising money helps with cash flow, but there's, you know, a frugality and a frugal nature that can be sort of used instead, so you don't actually need to raise the money. I know Brewmonster does a lot of sort of clever things and clever strategies around this.
If we take an example of someone like Neil, who's our head of design and illustration, the genius behind all of our branding, you know, every beer we've got a custom created monster hand drawn by him, and, you know, we probably had, you know, tens of thousands of pounds worth of value out of him. You know, he does freelance work and he charges a lot of money for his work because it's very high quality, yet we've never paid him a penny. We've given him shares in the business instead. Yeah, so another area that we've always been quite frugal is we don't take the, you know, so we open a bar, for example, we open a tap room, you know, we need a cellar, we need beer lines, we need chillers and stuff. What we, the default thing that most breweries and bars would probably do is go to an expert, get them to come in, install it all for you. Comes with a warranty, ongoing service, probably at a cost though. For us, it was never an option. We were never going to do it that way. For one, we should know how to do it ourselves anyway because we're in the industry. And number two, we're not going to go and spend the thousands of pounds to another company who's going to make their margin on it. We're going to do it ourselves and save that money. So, for example, when we built the tap room, we got someone to come in and put a mezzanine floor in. Obviously, we didn't pay full price. We got someone to come in and put a second-hand one in. And then when it came to doing the cellar and all the beer lines and the beer taps, we learned how to do it ourselves. And we had a couple of tricky days trying to get them to work, trying to get the beer to flow, not all fobbing. Wasted a bit of beer doing it as well. But ultimately, we learned so much about it and eventually got our beer pouring well. And now we're in a position where, and we're actually talking to a customer at the moment, so quite a high-profile bar in the centre of Cardiff. They've got a free beer line, which can be used but not set up. The knowledge we've gained from doing our own cellar and bar in the tap room, we're now using that knowledge to go and install our own beer line in their bar. Had we had to outsource that, I'd probably talking hundreds, if not £1,000, possibly. And we can do it ourselves now. gives us a real advantage over some of our competitors who perhaps, you know, would have either had to incur that cost or wouldn't be able to do it at all.
Okay, so that's about all we've got time for today. It's been a bit of an interview style episode. Obviously, Brewmonster have done 5 separate races, so quite an interesting story to tell. On the next episode, we're going to flip it around and Glenn's going to ask me a load of questions. We're going to talk about why I haven't raised any money so far for moderation, when would be a good time, how I might do it, and a bit more about sort of software app development and the nuances of raising money in that world where, you know, there is no manufacturing. Maybe the business plan is worth a bit less because it's all making up numbers effectively. I'm going to have 10 billion users, you know, by the end of next week. So that's what we got to look forward to next episode. Thanks everyone for listening. So Glenn, if people want to follow you or Brewmonster, where can they find out more about what you do?
Facebook is our main social platform, facebook.com/brewmonster. We do a little bit on Instagram, sharing some of our best pictures. And we do a little bit on Twitter, and hopefully we'll do a lot more on Twitter very soon.
Sounds exciting. So if you want to know more about moderation or what I'm doing on the internet, you can follow me on micro.blog. I'm at DOMZ, that's DOMZ. You can search for moderation in the App Store on the iPhone, or you can go to moderation.app. So Apple had their second quarterly announcement last week, and you know, some eager eyes were watching because obviously the quarter before was the sharp decline in iPhone sales, you know, largely linked to China. So the sort of headline figures are revenue of $58 billion, which is down 5%, you know, from the same quarter a year ago. iPad revenue up 22%.
Services, a lot, isn't it? What's doing that, do you reckon?
So a lot of it has been, so probably maybe a year or two ago, you know, the iPad went to a bit of a, you know, peak iPad state, if you will. People thought that was it, no longer growing.
Yeah.
And Apple obviously changed their strategy quite a lot. So they've released the Pro iPads, which was, you know, more expensive, so more revenue.
Yeah.
But also started innovating again, I guess. So, you know, they did the stylus. A lot of new technologies went into the Pros. And then I feel like they've just now finished that strategy turnaround. So they released the new iPad mini with the new sort of processors. The cheap iPad came out as well, targeting sort of education and just the, you know, like people like my mum, I guess.
Yeah.
So they've now got a full product line from, you know, a 7-inch iPad mini, a 9-inch, you know, cheap iPad, a 10.5-inch slightly bigger iPad. And then, you know, the 11-inch and the 12.9-inch Pros, you know, for the real people who want all the power and all the new stuff. So they're really covering all of it.
They should do, really, is, yeah. It's just because I think, it's like we've said before, the advantage of Apple over the others is not so much necessarily in the hardware anymore for me, because everything's just becoming more the same. Everybody can do... A lot of other companies out there nowadays could produce an iPad. You know, they might be restricted because of, you know, patents and trademarks, et cetera, et cetera. But effectively, everyone can get access to like similar technology or can recreate it. But what Apple's advantage would be is the sort of the ecosystem. But then the whole point of having the ecosystem is to have all of the different devices. So, and to be able to have all the devices, you know, you might need a cheap iPad because that's been used for X, but then you also want your MacBook, which is more powerful, so you can do something different on it. So you almost need to have the, you know, you need to be able to offer the range, not always just be at the top, at the high end of the pricing.
Yeah, I find this interesting because we've, you know, spoken about this many times, you know, not on a podcast, but for me, this signals that when things do start going wrong, Apple are able to change strategy and, you know, almost be honest enough with themselves to realize that the current strategy isn't the best. And you know, the last two quarters have been, you know, growing revenue for iPad, and I imagine it's probably going to continue because I think the iPad minis and some of the newest products were at the end of the last quarter, so they're not even factored into this one, really. It's all about the Pro in this one. So you know, probably next quarter will be equal, if not more, iPad growth, which, you know, there was 2 months, or two quarters, rather, of decline in revenue, and now that should be three quarters of growth, really.
Yeah. Because whilst I'm anti-Apple as a business, I sort of, you know, there are, like you said, there are signs that they are, you know, seeing the light coming round to the, you know, what I consider the better way of thinking, and, you know, offer more choice to people, you know, really try and get people to buy in and stick with their products. I think the way to that is, yeah, offering those different price points, and, you know, people will accept that, you know, you're buying a cheaper iPad, you're going to get, you know, a cheaper product, maybe in terms of materials and functionality, speed, etc. But I think people would be happy to do that. I think at least give people a choice, you know, people are intelligent enough to understand what, you know, the trade-offs are.
I think the cheapest iPad is probably the best value iPad, you know, you can buy. It's for the £320, I think it is. It's a brilliant device, I mean.
Yeah, but we bought one of those for, which we use as our till in the brewery tap, because, yeah. I guess partly because I, you know, I'm comfortable, I know how an iPad works, you know, because I've had one for years, I've had a couple actually, and I know, like, which apps to download and how, you know, how they're going to work as a till, etc. So, you know, rather than go and buy an Android, which might be cheaper, I bought an Apple one because I know how it works, etc. If, you know, if something goes wrong with it, I got an idea to fix it, you know, I know how to turn it on and off. But I wouldn't have done that if the only option was a £500 or £600 one. But the fact it was £320 and I'm able to get a student discount and we saved the VAT meant it was actually a low enough price point to make it worthwhile getting it.
So I think the reason I mentioned the sort of two quarters of decline in iPad revenue and then, you know, a turnaround effectively. So, you know, we've had two quarters of decline in year-over-year iPhone revenue now. So, you know, they've changed their strategy a bit here as well. You know, they've been sort of promoting the trade-in programs. They've been discounting prices in some countries. And the interesting part of the sort of the call, I guess, with the results call was one analyst sort of picked up on the fact that the guidance for the next quarter was an 8% drop versus this quarter, whereas normally it's about a 15% drop. And right. the CFO said that, you know, the smaller shortfall was due to Apple's confidence that the iPhone sales are strengthening. And, you know, they seem to think that they've solved some of their problems in China. It's now coming back. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on that, really. Do you think they've turned
me,
it around?
I think, I guess that, some of that for me is like sort of, you know, fundamentally flawed, because I always feel like there's so much focus on quarter by quarter revenue movements and what's the next quarter look like, and it's all this really short termism. I guess a lot of the times analysts are looking to try and make, you know, they're being measured on their financial performance over months and quarters, but for me, I think the bigger picture is always the more interesting bit, because we've been talking about Apple for years, and we were talking years ago about whether they're doing the right thing by having the highest priced products and, you know, by having a smaller market share than they could have had, etc., etc. So for me, it's like, yeah, that focus on these little, you know, minute quarter by quarter is just not really the right way to look at it. And I think that's one of the problems that come with being, you know, such a behemoth of a company. You know, there's so many analysts and investors out there that want to know every single thing day by day, that you end up becoming, you know, you're almost forced to manage it on that really minute level rather than being able to sort of step back and just think about the big picture.
So I think, you know, you make a good point, and I think the long-term view, you know, I think Apple's fairly open about where they're going, or, you know, what their strategy is. And
do you reckon? I'm not sure. Are they really? They sort of, they always keep things. What happened with their car? Are they still doing a car?
You know, they have an interest in automotive vehicles, I guess. But I think they, you know, if I had to summarize what I thought it was, the obvious thing is services. They've been banging on about services for a long time. That's now 20% of their, you know, revenue. Yeah. So the iPhone's 54%. Still quite a lot. Still, you know, relying on that a fair bit, but 20% services is, you know, really interesting. And then if you look at the sort of revenue growth on that, that's basically grown every quarter since they've been measuring it, I guess, or at least since sort of 2015. So it's continuous growth. It's not seasonal, so, you know, you sign up for iCloud storage or wherever, Apple Music, it's a monthly recurring revenue. So it doesn't have these big sort of dips, you know, after the holiday season. And it's slowly ticking up, slowly, you know. And Apple hasn't announced any new services.
I guess what I'm interested to understand really is almost their profit margin on each. And I know it's not as easy as that because, you know, services are dependent on the hardware, etc., etc. But sort of, you know, if you fast forwarded say 5 years, and services has become, you know, 60 or 80% of their revenue, what's it look like profitability wise? Is it better or is it worse? It could be better, I imagine, because
it's better. Yeah. So yeah, they actually announced the margin on this call. I don't think they've detailed it before, but they've probably been having it in their back pocket for a while. But yeah, so the margin, profit margin on services is 62%.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just pretty healthy.
Strong, yeah. More so, even though they got good margins on the iPhone, for me, that's going to evolve quite quickly with the competition that's out there nowadays.
Yeah, and I think off memory, I think the iPhone was like 50% or maybe a bit lower the last time they spoke about that. But, you know, so services is where they're going. But, you know, as I was saying, they've announced 3 or 4 new services, but none of them are actually live yet. So, you know, this growth is happening with, you know, the limited services they have. So it's going to be interesting over the next few years seeing how Apple TV Plus and News Plus and the gaming service, how they all impact this number.
It'd be interesting to see, because they make, 60-odd percent now on services is their sort of margin. But it'd be interesting to see how that goes in the future, because like when they started, they were, you know, sort of all-powerful, you know, they could have taken 95% of the, you know, the revenue on, say, like iTunes and, you know, App Store and stuff if they wanted to, you know, because people didn't have any choice.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the Apple ecosystem has created some other monstrous companies, you know, I guess Netflix, for example, how much have they surged, you know, since, you know, they've had like their app and they've been able to go, you know, sort of, you know, the streaming and things compared to what they would have been like before, you know, without Apple. So it's almost, will these sort of behemoths that are being created, will they be able to wrestle back the more and more of the power, and then they can take their bigger share at the expense of Apple, you know, in a sort of a, you know, 5-year timeline? I don't know. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. You know, the thing that caught my eye as well was, you know, you think, what is Apple? And you think, well, iPhone, Mac, iPad. But, you know, the Mac and iPad revenue combined is smaller than services. So, you know, it's really come out of nowhere almost, I guess, but it's, you know, where they're heading, and there's question marks around, is that the right strategy for them? Because, you know, traditionally they've not been great at services. They've, you know, the Mobile Me, sort of, which was the precursor to iCloud, was famously a pile of basically, and, you know, they're not really that proven in that arena.
I guess, but going back to my point, because you think, like, so say Netflix, for example, so say, you know, without Apple, Netflix, you know, wouldn't be where they were, say. And Apple have, you know, made a lot of money out of Netflix, you know, growth over the years. But now Netflix have got to a size where, okay, they're not as powerful as an Apple or as big or as rich as an Apple. But, you know, if they were to threaten that they're going to come off, you know, Apple's ecosystem entirely, and they're only going to do it through Google and whatever else is out there, I guess, you know, that could have a significant impact on Apple's services in the future. It could shift people from, you know, over a couple of years, it could shift people from their ecosystem and their, you know, the iPhone and iPad and the Mac over to a rival. So, you know, if you've got more and more of these companies just being created by Apple, then it also, you know, is a bit of a threat to them, I guess, in the long term as well.
I think it's an interesting topic, probably one as well we should really discuss in detail in a future sort of episode, because it's really interesting power dynamics. So Facebook and Apple is another one.
Yeah, Facebook's a good example. Like, yeah, where would Facebook be without Apple?
But, you know, it's hard to see. Like, Apple would never, you know, kill the Facebook app if they did some privacy thing, you know, forever, because everyone would be complaining, well, I can't go on Facebook. But then equally, Facebook can't pull their app from iPhones because there's just too many users. So it's almost like mutually assured destruction. They both need each other, and they, you know, there's this power dynamic and power struggle where they tiptoe around and try little things, but they can't really upset each other too much.
I guess my thinking is that as, say, Facebook in relative terms grows compared to Apple, they're just able to sort of eke a bit more out of that margin that Apple are enjoying at the moment. And there's going to be more of these companies going to come along and do the same thing. So And there's ways that Facebook could do it. You know, they could start to offer some slightly better services or something. You know, maybe they almost charge a little bit on Facebook, but you know, no ads on Android, and little things that could over time would maybe just start to move people across. So there's, you know, there's, I guess there's ways they could do it. But I think it's not that they would necessarily, you know, go full on cam off Apple altogether, because like I said, it'd be, you know, catastrophic for them. But there's things they can do, and just, you know, that 60% margin might shrink over time. And you know, the rise of the home assistant as well, you know, going from no smartphones to smartphones is what, you know, made Apple what it is. If the next sort of big thing in the world is to move from, you know, screens in the form of iPads, iPhones, onto, you know, just you know, assistants, you know, voice controlled assistants, they're not really as strong in that market, are they?
No,
so
I guess
that could be another threat to them.
That brings us on to probably the last real big segment of revenue that we haven't really spoken about, which is, it used to be called Other, but they've renamed it to Wearables, Home, and Accessories. So, you know, this is basically watch and AirPods, because, you know, the HomePod doesn't really sell enough to impact this. So, let me just pull up the number.
9% of the...
Yeah, so it's been growing quarter on quarter, you know, similar trend to services, really, you know, growth every quarter since 2015. But the comment I thought was interesting was, you know, people think this is the watch, but actually AirPods has had a really big impact on these numbers. They don't release the, you know, the unit sales, but, you know, they said demand for AirPods has been incredible. It's a cultural phenomenon. And basically, you know, they've been struggling to keep up with that demand. So I wanted to get your thoughts, really. Have you seen many people wearing these AirPods? Is it a cultural phenomenon?
I definitely think it's a cultural phenomenon. I think they always have a nice way of, like, buttering things up to make them sound like, you know... It's not too difficult to be able to come up with a statement like that. You can restrict your supply somewhat to say, oh, we can't make enough of them. It's like, yeah, it doesn't mean that this is like there's so much demand. I mean, you might only be making a small number. Cultural phenomenon is, I guess, quite vague in terms of the specifics of actually what does that actually mean. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's as big as that. And haven't Samsung got something that's very similar now?
Yeah.
So it didn't take long for them to be able to copy that and come up with something that's, you know, presumably, you know, it's probably not as good, not as matured yet, but, you know, give it another year or two, I'd have thought they'd probably be almost indistinguishable.
I think again, it's like they were giving them away with the phone if you pre-ordered it. You know, I don't know what the price is. I imagine it's lower. So, you know, we talk about margins. We talk about Apple's ability to sell these things and sell them to just more people at the higher price point. I think that's coming through in these sort of financials. And I imagine the Samsung Buds or whatever they're called is not going to make any impact on their financials.
Yeah, I just imagine, like, you say you're a parent and you've got a 12-year-old kid, and 12-year-old kid is finally, you know, starting to get to the point where they want the phone, they want the AirPods because it's a cultural phenomenon, and an iPad, etc. You're sort of, you know, you're a parent, you're thinking, bloody hell, that's, how much is all that together? It's a couple of grand. You know, you might sort of try and push them down the route of, well, why don't you have an Android one that's made in China? That's going to be half the price and the AirPods come for free or something like that. I don't know, it'd be interesting to know what the sort of the sales are like by say, like, age group and demographic, you know, to understand, you know, what's the world going to look like in a couple of years. Because that higher price point, like you said, it means better margins for them. You know, is the sort of, say, Samsung model more sustainable if, you know, they're not making the money and possibly a bit of a loss leader for them? But what's going to happen in a couple of years, you know? Yeah, sometimes quite interesting. And that's not something that's going to come out of, you know, analysts looking at quarter by quarter earnings and is it up 5% when they're expecting it to be up 6%, etc. But, you know, a bit further down the line.
I'm glad you mentioned Samsung. We'll talk about him in a second. I just want to get your last thoughts on, you know, Apple financially. Are you worried long term? Are they in a good position?
I think they're okay. How many hundreds of billion have they got in the bank now?
300, I think.
Has it gone down? I thought it was more than that.
Yes. Maybe it's more. I don't know.
It's not bad. It's not bad, is it? You know, 300 billion. I think they're okay. For me, though, it's for them like, to become a failure in inverted commas. It's not necessarily they go bust, but given that they were the most valuable company in the world, considered the biggest brand in the world, you know, almost more money in the bank than, you know, every other company out there. I guess for them, failure could be that in 5 years, that all of a sudden they don't have as much money in the bank. They're worth half what they are now. They're not considered the brand they were. Do you mean, even though they could still be profitable, they could still have $100 billion in the bank. That, you know, it's still a massive, you know, successful company, but it's sort of, it would still be considered a failure compared to what they got now. Do you mean, it's the ability for them to stay where they are, retain that position, or to continue in the same vein. Because the likes of, I think Microsoft now have, you know, become another trillion-dollar company. You know, Amazon have continued their charge, you know, for the last couple of years. So, you know, will Apple be able to keep up with all of these and continue to, you know, go into these new heights, or are they going to end up falling back? So,
I guess we'll see. So, have you been following much about the Samsung Galaxy Fold?
Oh, only that I know that they had some issues with it.
some issues.
A couple of issues, I think.
Yeah, so they sent out review units, you know, to journalists and blog writers to obviously spend a few days with the device and then write in a review just before they launch it. And I'm pretty sure every single one they sent out broke.
It's just shocking how that can happen. Like, I mean, how can that, surely the first 100 that must have come off, they must have tested. Like, you know, proper stress test them as well. It's not like the first 100 that came off the production line again sent out, surely. That's just it's just bonkers, like, how that can happen, isn't it?
But even if that was the case, you know, a bad batch, you know, that's fair enough. That could happen. It's, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. But then what they did was they effectively cancelled the launch date. I think they had, you know, launch parties planned and all of that. They pulled all those and said, you know, released a statement saying we've had some issues, we'll communicate a new launch date soon, you know, bear with us. And then in between that, iFixit, which take apart, you know, devices, you must have seen these before.
Yeah.
So they got their hands on one, took it apart, criticized some of its design, saying, well, this bit here is where all the debris is going to go and that's why it's going to break. And that was then pulled, you know, at Samsung's request. They didn't want that on the internet. And then I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday, they sent an email to everyone who pre-ordered one saying, we're going to assume that your pre-order is cancelled. If you really, really, really want it, click this button. We don't know when we're going to ship it yet. We'll keep you updated. So I think it's a fundamental design flaw here. There's not a, you know, bad batch or the, you know.
Yeah.
And this leads me down the path of, were they, or is the culture for Samsung being first? And, you know, did they know Huawei, or however you pronounce it, were also going to release a Fold phone, and they wanted to make sure theirs was announced first and shipped first? And is that the right culture to have?
I guess they are trying to establish, like, maybe a brand for, you know, that's up there with the Apples of the world, to be like, you know, yeah, we're doing the best products, we bring them out first, you know, we're pushing the innovation boundaries. But yeah, clearly they haven't got the sort of internal processes and that to be able to actually deliver on it. And given that only a couple of years ago, you know, they had the whole, you know, exploding phones or catching fire phones, you know, which they seem to recover from. They had quite a good marketing campaign off the back of it where they were sort of showing this really thorough test and they were doing, and, you know, that seems to have been forgotten about. Surely it should still be in the back of their minds that we can't have another up at that level.
I think the next phone was waterproof, so you can, you know, throw water over if it catches on fire.
Oh, is that why they did it?
No, I don't know. That's a joke. Yeah, so, you know, I can only assume that the sort of senior people in the company said, no, we have to announce this. It's happening. You know, we'll fix any issues.
Yeah.
And there must be people on the ground who are making this product, doing the quality control, saying, this thing doesn't work. It's going to break. Yeah. Don't do it. So I think that's a really disconcerting sort of disconnect, really, between...
Yeah, it's quite poor, like, leadership to be like, yeah, you know, they need to be closer and, you know, they need to think big picture. I guess they're a bit too, like, sort of parochial in looking at, no, we've just got to achieve this goal of being, you know, to get be the first one to bring it out.
stomach rumbling.
It was, yeah.